From Camp Hill to Katanning, Fraser to Greenville, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Pennsylvania voters approved two constitutional amendments giving lawmakers the power to end Governor Tom Wolf's COVID-19 emergency declaration. And they are doing just that. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is here to host a Capital Watch roundtable discussion. And a trove of recently released emails have called into question Dr. Anthony Fauci's actions in dealing with the pandemic. I'll have a town hall commentary on why we no longer trust many of our nation's institutions. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to our Capital Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first we have news headlines from patownhall.com. Key lawmakers in charge of potential election reforms in Pennsylvania appear split on whether a third-party audit of the state's November election results will occur. According to the Center Square, former President Donald Trump called legislative leaders seeking, quote, a full forensic audit, end quote, of the state's election results, similar to that now underway in Arizona. State Senator David Argel, who chairs the Senate State Government Committee, said he is considering the request. His counterpart in the House, Representative Seth Grove, said his committee will not be authorizing any audit and that they are focusing on reforming the system going forward. In political news, Congresswoman Chrissy Houlihan, who represents a suburban Philadelphia district, ended speculation that she might run for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by retiring U.S. Senator Pat Toomey. Houlihan said she will seek re-election to her congressional seat and forego a Senate race. A number of candidates have already announced for that seat. Meanwhile, State Senator Scott Martin of Lancaster County this past week announced formation of an exploratory committee to consider a run for the Republican gubernatorial nomination. Governor Tom Wolf is term limited and cannot seek re-election, so that race is attracting a growing number of candidates on the Republican side, while Attorney General Josh Shapiro is generally viewed as the front runner for the Democratic nomination. A rally in support of Second Amendment rights was held on the steps of the state capitol this week. The annual event is organized by State Representative Daryl Metcalf, who is pressing for passage of a constitutional carry bill and a bill to limit local gun ordinances that are more restrictive than state or federal laws. Such legislation has taken on urgency as the Biden administration has proposed a number of measures aimed at restricting gun rights. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. It has been a busy week in Harrisburg as lawmakers flex their new constitutional power to end Governor Tom Wolf's COVID-19 emergency powers. Our Capital Watch crew is here to talk about that and other major legislative actions. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is joined by Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and by Matthew Briette from Commonwealth Partners Chamber of Entrepreneurs. David?
And welcome once again to Capital Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, your all-star cast of experts, Rebecca Euler, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association. Rebecca, thanks for being here.
Happy to be here again, David. Thank you.
And my main man, Matt Briette, President and CEO of Commonwealth Partner Chamber of Entrepreneurs. Thanks for being with us.
Good to be with you both.
So welcome to Liberated Pennsylvania. We are now living in the post-lockdown era that the governor's stranglehold on power has been broken by the voters who approved a constitutional amendment. And so now we got to figure out what comes next.
Yeah, the two-week shutdown opened up after a little over a year, I guess, or more.
To flatten the curve.
Flatten the curve, we did.
Yes. David and Rebecca, you know, the voters spoke loudly on May 18. They said no governor should have unilateral and unlimited powers to determine what businesses are essential or non-essential and do things without any input from their elected officials. And unfortunately, Governor Wolf really brought this on himself. Had he worked with the House and Senate and dealt with things as they arose rather than continually vetoing and shutting out our elected officials in dealing with things of how we can protect both lives and livelihoods. And I think that that's why the governor got smacked down on May 18, that voters said, no, the legislature should be able to end an emergency declaration with a simple majority vote in the House and Senate, and that those declarations should be limited to 21 days. And the only way that you can continue them is by approval from the very elected officials in the House and the Senate. And so this really brought this us more in line with the way other states deal with this, of a balance of power. And we saw this all across the state. But Pennsylvania, and this is kudos to Pennsylvania voters, were the first ones in the country to be able to use the constitutional powers to curtail an executive's abuse of power.
Now that the legislature is empowered to end the emergency, that's what they need to do.
Well, yes. So a lot of folks, of course, thought, oh, May 18 happens. These amendments are approved. So doesn't that mean that the emergency declaration is over?
No.
Well, not so fast.
Not exactly.
I mean, yeah, there's a number of things that have to happen. And unfortunately, as you might expect, Governor Wolf's Department of State has been dragging its feet in certifying the vote, because you have to have, you know, all of the counties certify the votes and confirm that, yes, this was victorious or was not. And so you've had that time lag of the vote certification, which I believe as we're recording still has not been officially certified.
That's obscene, because you've had the Department of State act corruptly by deliberately misrepresenting the question as it appeared on the ballot before the voters.
That's correct. And I mean, part of this is, we had a Supreme Court that rewrote the law that then led to the need for this constitutional amendment. But that same Supreme Court has thrown our elections and the standards up in the air, because here's an example. We had a lot of mail-in voting that happened, of course, in last November and even in this primary election. One of the things that the court said is that undated mail-in ballots are invalid. But we had some county commissioners in Montgomery that decided we're counting them. Philadelphia County tried to do so. The House Republicans threatened impeachment of those election officers. They backed off, said, okay, we will not count them. But you still have some counties that are not obeying the law, or at least the rulings from the state court. So there's still a lot of things in flux. And I mean, we can throw into this, you've got some election reforms that are coming out from the House State Government Committee, because there's a lot of things that unfortunately have given people a loss of confidence in our governor, in his powers, in some of these elections, and certainly our Supreme Court.
We need these office holders to respect the fact that they are entrusted with the powers of these offices. These powers don't belong to them. These offices don't belong to them. They belong to the people, and that we, the people of Pennsylvania, have made them the temporary trustees of these offices. And that, you know, again, all these people take oaths. They take oaths of office that they're going to respect the Constitution and uphold the law. And yet we see so many of these office holders, once they're elected, they use that as just like a beachhead. Mm-hmm. And like, we're going to go and we're going to just like gain as much power and as much control as we can, even if it's well outside the established parameters of these offices. It's a really dangerous trend.
Well, I think that one of the things that's really important here, it's not that we don't believe that an executive needs to have the ability to respond quickly when there's a crisis, an emergency. But what these amendments did and why they were really important is that it restores a balance of power. It says, no, a governor can make an emergency declaration and have all those powers. And we want that, right? I mean, if we had a terrorist attack or some natural disaster.
God forbid, yes.
Yeah, right? You need to have an executive. But what we dealt with here was an executive who explicitly excluded the people's representative. And when he—
And the people themselves. I mean, this administration didn't accept input from any of the stakeholders.
Right. Right.
Never asked people, hey, how would this play out in the real world if we adopted this policy proposal? People had to bang on the doors to try to get through to the administration just to school them on the mistakes that they were making.
You know what? And I think what amazes me is we had a functioning legislature last year. I mean, it's not like they weren't meeting. They were meeting. They were conducting official business. There was no reason why the legislature couldn't be involved in the process or providing input, passing laws, working with the governor to implement solutions. But they were completely shut out, as you said. I think there were 9 vetoes last year, something along those lines, that he just refused to work. And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, but our Constitution was written in, what, 1968?
1968,
the revision. Right. The modern
Constitution, yes. Yep. So it took a toxic mix of this abuse of power, as Matt was talking about, from the governor, combined with the Supreme Court rulings, which threw our election into disarray and backed up the governor on his abusive powers last year, that really was what set it over the top and had made it so that the voters had to step in and reset this balance of power.
Yeah, and I'm still just going to be angry for a while about the deliberate misrepresentation of the question that to go before the voters.
That's fair.
I mean, like, that is a corrupt act that was deliberately undertaken to affect the outcome. And that's just not acceptable.
Well, and that thankfully the voters were able to look past that and understand what was being done there. But you're absolutely right, David. Before many months ago, we looked at those questions and had a survey of Republican voters. And more than a quarter of them were voting no based on that language, that biased language that even many Democrats, elected Democrats, said it was disingenuous. Mm-hmm. By what the Wolf administration did. So the fact that it got over the goal line, I think, is a testament to the people's understanding of what, you know, the abuses that were there and why we needed to curtail them.
And it makes you wonder what the result would have been had the questions been clear. I kind of wonder what the...
It'd have been 90-10, I guarantee.
Right. I kind of wonder that as well.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor, from Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me, Rebecca Euler from the Pennsylvania Motor Truck Association and Matt Briette from Commonwealth Partners. So because the electorate voted yes to amend the Constitution to end the unlimited power of the governor and to restore balance, this creates an opportunity. It's a beachhead. It's not self-fulfilling, but it at least creates the opportunity for the legislature to step in and to reshape the circumstances that we find ourselves in. So again, as of this moment in time, as we're talking here together, that the House has passed a resolution ending the emergency declaration.
That's correct. And it's on to the Senate. Of course, Governor Wolf is claiming, oh, we're going to lose federal money and there's all these problems. Well, we have many states that no longer have an emergency declaration still in place. So I think that there were a lot of red herrings and scare tactics in that. Now, there were a number of things that we should continue. Right. I mean, we saw a suspension of some regulatory issues, and it's kind of like, hey, we don't need these things.
Yes,
and
we proved it.
That's right. Yep. We proved it. So I think in some ways you have a dog that caught the car and then figure out what do you do with this? All right. So we rescind this. How do we get back to normal in this? Well, also recognizing, hey, we have an executive that should something come up that we have to react. This isn't a putting all of the power in the hands of the House and Senate. That's not what this did.
Yeah. Tom Wolf declared, because of the emergency, that the Office of Open Records couldn't function. And so because the Office of Open Records was itself shuttered, that it was not available to the clock didn't start ticking on right-to-know requests, which under Pennsylvania's Sunshine Act, like, the citizenry is owed a timely response, and that deliberately closing that one particular office so that open records requests couldn't be accepted or processed is, again, a deeply corrupt, very offensive thing.
And if there's any time the public needs to know what's happening and have a response to a right-to-know request, it's during an emergency declaration where the governor has unlimited powers.
Well, and that's it is an unfortunate thing that the governor who claimed to be Mr. Transparency became the most opaque administration that you could have. The legislature was passing laws trying to say, here's what we should do. Here's why we ought not to be one of only two states in the country that doesn't have construction going on. You can do this safely. And so they were doing these things, but the governor wasn't meeting with them. But why? The governor didn't have to. He had unilateral and unlimited powers. And again, this is why, you know, thankfully, and this isn't about just Governor Wolf. This is about any governor.
Correct.
I mean, Democrat
nobody
or
should have this much power.
That's right.
No one.
And it's why the people's representatives need to be at that table. And frankly, look, again, if we had an ongoing disaster, I guarantee you that the partisanship of saying we need an executive making those decisions, that would be set aside. And that they would say, absolutely, the governor needs to move on this. And you would have full support. But when you totally exclude them, you're going to lose any support that you would have otherwise had.
Power corrupts. Absolute power corrupts. Right. Absolutely. These are things we already know. So legislature is in session, and it's almost like we're entering the post-Wolf era early, that the governor, the spell being broken, that I think the status of lame duck is very much applicable to his circumstance. But we saw the General Assembly move on a really notable piece of education reform legislation. Matt, can you tell us about that?
Yes. It's Senate Bill 1 and House Bill 1, which demonstrates the priority for our General Assembly, the House and the Senate, and it's focused on education, which, of course, many, many people know the disruption that far too many students experience over the last year and a half, and the loss of education that they experienced because, well, frankly, schools refused to open. And then, of course, the impact that that had on families, and even today, families trying to get back to work, but without childcare or a school to send their children to. So Senate Bill 1, House Bill 1 would be the most robust expansion of giving parents educational options that they don't have today.
Because my understanding is that under Pennsylvania's Education Improvement Tax Credit and the Opportunity Scholarship Tax Credit, that there's a waiting list of like tens of thousands of kids who want these scholarships, want this opportunity, but they can't get it.
Yeah. I mean, just in Philadelphia, 40,000 kids on waiting lists for charter schools.
Wow.
We've got over nearly 60,000 kids all across Pennsylvania looking for EITC scholarships. And that's minimum. Those are who we know that would want these. And so what Senate Bill 1 does is says, you know what, we need to start funding kids rather than institutions.
Mm-hmm.
And have the money follow the child. Now, we're not talking about vouchers here. We're talking about expanding the EITC. We're talking about creating education opportunity scholarship accounts, which are basically saying this money is dedicated for education, whether it's tuition or tutoring or things that help you get back on track for the education you've lost. And so this is saying, look, education is so important. And if we are going to go this route where we're going to shut down where 90% of the kids are going to school, we need to give them options and opportunities. Families need them, particularly low-income families.
Yep.
That where those public schools are not working for them already.
Yep.
This would help target those families to make sure that their kids don't get further and further behind.
So we had it's moved again at this moment as we're speaking. It has cleared the Senate Education Committee and is on the Senate calendar for consideration.
That's right. So it will go through the Senate and get a full vote in the Senate and then move on to the House. And all part of this, Dave and Rebecca, is, as you know, laying out some markers for the budget negotiations, which is where you tend to have a lot of your policy discussions. And I think that this is the opportunity for Republicans in particular to show, look, we're standing with parents, not with the adults in the school system that benefit from it, but the parents who have been hurt, the kids who have been hurt. And we want to do all we can in this budget to make sure that kids can get access to the schools that are serving their needs.
Yeah, and we'll need to get together to do another show about upcoming budget deliberations because there are so many issues. There are so many moving parts.
Lots of issues.
And one of the things, just again, to get into that, or at least foreshadow a little bit, you know, while we are in a temporary condition of having a surplus, excess revenues, like, this is just a complete illusion, because we are coming up on some really bad, you know, debts that have to be paid and other economic problems. Like, we are not, just because we have cash on hand right now, that does not mean that we're flush.
Yeah, and the money trees in Washington, which never existed in the first place, they're not going to continue producing these kinds of surpluses that the state's experiencing right now.
Yeah, feds can't print money indefinitely and should not.
Yeah.
Goodness gracious. So anyway, so there we are. Anyway, we're getting down to the end of the time that we have. Rebecca, last thoughts from you about the week gone by.
Well, I mean, you started out the show talking about free Pennsylvania. Here we are, freedom Pennsylvania. So I am just really excited that here we finally, it's been a long haul, but we're finally at the point where we see an end. And I'll just stop there, because I'm excited about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm excited, but I'm also concerned, because we've had more than a year of people, many of them being paid to not work, making more money sitting at home than actually on the job. Are we creating a new mentality and belief that, well, government just prints money and everything is okay?
Yeah.
Because as you know, David, I mean, it's not. I mean, these things are going to come home to roost. And so that's what I'm concerned about, is the future. Is like, what have we taught our kids? What have we taught people that of how we have handled this? I think we've handled it very, very poorly. We've become very, very soft. I mean, our ancestors that made America what it is.
Yes.
I think are
conquered
saying,
the continent and built a great nation.
That's right.
No,
that's
disagreement
right.
Those are
the things that concern me, is what will be the fallout from this and the ramifications of how we've failed to handle this.
I hear you.
Yeah. Hopefully, it will be lessons learned.
Yes, we're going to have to do that. Well, and I'm sure we'll be talking about them a bit.
Yes. So please come back next time. This is all the time that we have. Matt, where can people go to learn more about you and what you do?
Yes, go to thecommonwealthpartners.com.
And Rebecca, where's your organization? Where can they learn about you?
PMTA.org.
Outstanding. And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org and on the Pennsylvania Cable Network on Sunday mornings at 8:30. So for Matt, Rebecca, and me, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. In God We Trust is our national motto, at least until the woke crowd gets around to canceling it. God, it appears, is the only one worthy of our trust. The national institutions, which at one point had credibility and evoked trust, have one by one proven they are no longer worthy. This shattering of trust has occurred over time, but accelerated during the COVID-19 pandemic as political science replaced actual science in much of the government and media response. At the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, most Americans looked to the Centers for Disease Control and Dr. Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, as experts whose advice we should follow in stemming the spread of the virus. We were told to follow the science, and they were the ones producing the science. Contradictory directions and periodically disproven science soon followed, shaking the nation's confidence. In recent weeks, we have come to find out it was more than just learning new facts as the pandemic unfolded. We now know political interference, deliberate hiding of facts, and disinformation were baked into so-called scientific fact. Particularly disturbing is a trove of Dr. Fauci's emails obtained by a BuzzFeed reporter through a Freedom of Information Act request. A review of the emails finds inconsistencies or outright lies involving the necessity for wearing masks, development of the vaccine, and the possibility that COVID-19 is a man-made construct that leaked from a lab at the Wuhan Institute of Virology. In the politically charged atmosphere that was 2020, the lab leak theory was dismissed as a reckless conspiracy. But now, after months of news media cover-up and big tech censorship, the possibility, indeed the probability, that the virus originated in that lab has become real. At this point, nobody except for left-wing sycophants will believe otherwise, even if the presidential commission now looking into the virus's origins finds it occurred naturally. If proven COVID-19 escaped from a Wuhan lab, the Chinese Communist Party is in serious trouble. Their failure to report and contain the leak left the world unprepared for the contagion to come. Fauci, the CDC, the news media, big tech, politicians, and others who stifled investigation into the issue in an effort to politically damage Donald Trump will find their own credibility destroyed. The CDC suffered another blow to its credibility when it was learned the American Federation of Teachers put its thumb on the scale of school reopening recommendations. This was done at a time when the education establishment was pushing for billions in funding under the American Rescue Plan. A reopening of schools would have undermined arguments that the funding was needed. As a result of this political interference, millions of schoolchildren had their return to the classroom delayed, while billions of unnecessary dollars were appropriated for schools. Even worse, much of that money won't be spent until 2023 and beyond, further pointing to its uselessness in ensuring school safety. Another disturbing collaboration occurred between Fauci and Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg. American Commitment President Phil Kirpin has questioned why portions of the Fauci-Zuckerberg emails were redacted. The emails were sent at a time when the social media giant's so-called fact-checkers were censoring posts related to COVID-19 that did not follow the anti-Trump script. As all of these details tumble out of the closet, and more are likely to follow, the American public has learned one thing. Ronald Reagan was right when he said, "Trust but verify." Reagan said it in the context of dealing with the Soviet Union, but that communist empire has proven to be more trustworthy than many of our current domestic institutions. It is now crystal clear that political science, specifically the left's overwhelming hatred of Donald Trump, rather than actual science, dominated the COVID-19 response. Worse, the left, which never lets a disaster go to waste, has used the virus to vastly expand the size and scope of the federal government with a spending spree unprecedented in peacetime. The loss of life, personal freedom, and economic well-being has been incalculable. Going forward, it is important that we get the actual facts surrounding the development of COVID-19 and that we hold accountable those who created it and those whose actions to hide the truth prevented us from dealing more effectively with a pandemic. With a Town Hall Commentary, I'm Loman Henry. And if you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 26 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WXBQ-FM, WKMC-AM, and WBRX-FM in Altoona, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, and the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.